This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. This has been the week of the Rubio rollout, Florida Republican Senator Marco Rubio's book tour.
Senator Rubio, good morning.
Good morning, guys. Thanks for having me.
Our newsmaker of the morning, Florida Senator Marco Rubio. It's great to see you.
Thank you. It's like ESPN for day traders.
Yes. Many in your party feel that they can sort of run out the clock.
I don't agree with anyone who thinks that somehow we should wait until after the elections to deal with the major issues.
But everyone is.
Well, Senator Marco Rubio, welcome to All Things Considered.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on the show to talk about the book.
The book is coming out at an opportune moment when people are wondering, is Marco Rubio a likely Republican vice presidential candidate? Do you think the book gives you a good accounting of who you are?
Well, it gives my perspective of who I am. But it's not just about me. I mean, the book talks about my grandfather. It talks about my mother and father. It talks about growing up and my observations on certain policy issues and how I form my opinion on them. And as far as the timing, I mean, we published it when it was ready.
I felt like I missed something in your account of your salad days, which is pretty detailed. I mean, we go through a lot of football games and proms and your growth as a teenager. But you describe, for example, when you were a kid in Las Vegas, your father was in the Culinary Workers Union. They were on strike. You walked a picket line, and now with some great regret, you blamed your father for going back to work. You go from being kind of son of a Reagan Democrat Cuban-American family to being quite conservative. Was there something you read or experienced which made you deeply conservative and Republican for life?
Well, two things that emerged during my growing up. First, I think the first thing that led me to Reagan and to conservatism, specifically as it was viewed in the 1980s, was this review that America's role in the world was indispensable. I think as I got older, one of the things I grew to appreciate was the American free enterprise system. My dad was a bartender, and my mom was a cashier and a maid and other jobs. And I came to recognize that the reason why they had those jobs is because someone who made some money invested that money opening up a hotel where they were able to work and provide for us. And that the job of government was to create the conditions where that would be encouraged and possible in the future.
Former Florida Governor Jeb Bush figures in your story. I mean, you describe him as a significant supporter and influence from the beginning of your political career. Last week, he said this about his father and Ronald Reagan, and fitting into today's Republican Party. He said, Reagan would have, based on his record of finding accommodation, finding some degree of common ground, as would my dad, they would have a hard time if you define the Republican Party as having an orthodoxy that doesn't allow for disagreement, doesn't allow for finding some common ground. That was taken as a comment on the Tea Party approach of the Republican Party. Has Jeb Bush got it right or wrong?
Well, I don't think he meant that as a comment on the Tea Party approach, and I don't think the Tea Party approach is that, by the way. I think there are some in both political parties who believe that our way or the highway perspective, and I think we always have to remind ourselves that while we should never compromise our principles, there's always room to compromise on ideas about how to put those principles into practice, and I think that's where the debate has to happen.
But you're facing a fiscal crisis at the end
of
this year, for example. Do you just assume you're going to have to vote for something which will include big elements that you don't like, and Democrats are going to vote for big things they don't like?
Well, I think we're going to have to vote for something that solves the problem. Whatever we vote on has to solve things. For example, I don't have a moral or religious objection to tax increases. I just think they hurt growth and job creation, and that's why I don't think any solution should have tax increases. Not because I have some sort of orthodoxy on tax increases. It's because I believe that by raising taxes, we hurt growth.
You write a good deal about religion in the book, yours and your family's. And at one point, you describe being a state legislator, working part-time for a law firm, struggling to make ends meet. You, your wife, and your baby have moved into your mother-in-law's house. You went to Mass, prayed, and on your way back, your cell phone rang with an offer of a better job at a different law firm.
An offer of an interview.
Of an interview, excuse me.
Right.
Okay. You write this. Was it a miracle? I don't know. I do know that whatever fortune or misfortune we encounter in our lives, God expects it to lead us closer to him. When you say, was it a miracle, are you leaving open a serious possibility? Are you being ironic? What are you saying?
Well, look, about faith. I mean, obviously, people that have no faith or don't think faith worked that way would read that passage and say it just happened because it happened.
Mm-hmm.
From my perspective, I think the important issue is not that I got the job. The important issue is that at a time of worry, I turned to God for a solution. And that's what he wants from us. That's what my faith teaches, is that God wants us to rely on him, not just on ourselves.
But when I watched you campaign for the Republican Senate nomination, you were at the Villages, the huge retirement community. And after you spoke, we heard from a prayer circle, a group of women, who told us that God has chosen Rubio. This is the one. There are some people who approach politics in that way. Do you?
God chooses all of us, and he calls us to. But the first thing we have to know about that my faith teaches about God is that what he wants is a relationship with you. And he wants us to rely on him the way a child would rely on a parent.
I want to ask you to lay to rest the Washington Post story that you acknowledge in the end of the book. You call it an overreach, and this was written by Manuel Roig Francia, who now has his book out about you, The Rise of Marco Rubio. It's all about when your parents came from Cuba, in what year. He reported that despite your accounts that your parents came here after Fidel Castro took power, they in fact came 3 years earlier in 1956, which I gather is the case. When that story broke, I went back to the recording of the interview that you gave me at your home in West Miami back in October 2009 to hear what you had told me. We'd never put it on the air, but this is what you told me in October 2009.
They came in the late 50s, 1959, I think.
But did they come already married, or did
yes.
they?
Yes. They actually met. My dad was a security guard at the equivalent of a five and dime in Cuba.
At that time, were you unclear as to when?
Yeah, I didn't know the date. And I think you hear it in the interview.
I think.
But here's the point. First of all, I discovered the date, and I stopped saying it. In fact, it had already been reported before the Washington Post did that my parents had come before Castro. The second part of the overreach is that somehow create the perception that my entire public image was based on this notion that my parents came after Fidel instead of before Fidel. That distinguishing characteristic is just not that big a deal in the Cuban-American community, and the evidence is and the reaction to the story and what it's been.
Well, but the argument was that given the choice, the more iconic story is the family that came after Castro, and so it's a slightly better story.
That's not accurate either. First of all, there have always been Cuban exiles. Mm. My story was never the story of two parents that got on a speedboat and escaped Castro's machine guns. Mm. I never said my dad was a political prisoner that had been jailed and ran for his life. All I discussed was a time frame. Of course, I wish I had known the date, but it wouldn't have changed their story. The bottom line is that my parents were permanently separated from the country that they loved. My dad had to leave Cuba never again. After the last time he went, was he able to see his brothers before they passed away or his sister? And that was the essence of our story. And let me tell you something. It was a blessing in disguise, because what it did is it forced me to go back and learn more detail about my parents and discover things about them that made them even more interesting than I thought they were.
I first heard you addressing a Florida delegation breakfast at the 2008 Republican convention, and then I met you and watched you campaigning for the Republican nomination for Senate. And now that you've been in the Senate, what would you say is the biggest thing that you've learned and perhaps the biggest change that you've experienced since being a senator?
Well, I think just the time balance that the book talks a lot about some of the worries that I have about whether I'm balancing my time between my obligations to my family and my children, who deserve to have as much of me as I had of my dad, and the obligations I have to the public. I think my biggest concern would be the lack of urgency in Washington about addressing some of these issues that we face in a forceful way. And I hope that will change, because the problems that we face aren't going to go away on their own. They have to be confronted. They have to be solved.
Senator Marco Rubio of Florida,
author
of An American Son, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you for having me.
This is NPR.